Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Family Matters. I'm Jill Ajizi, and of course, Judge Michelle Lawrence is here with me. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Jill.
How are you?
Well, do you want to congratulate each other for a good program on Saturday?
Let's do a little atta girl. I think we should, because we put on something on Saturday that was meaningful to a lot of people, meaningful to you and I. We were at DePaul Law Center on Saturday from 9 until 4 with tons of alienated parents and some great, great speakers. Dr. Mike Bone from Orlando flew in. We had Jim Pritikin, who, of course, is Dwayne Wade's attorney, successful decision on that case. And we had Mike Jeffries. You spoke, I spoke, questions galore, and it was just a day that was unforgettable.
Yeah, it was. It went off really well. Hopefully we'll be able to get parts of that for our listeners to hear online. We're working on the technology now.
Yes, we are, and we hope to have that up, and we hope to get you some of the materials that we disseminated at the conference as well, because they would be very helpful if you're going through the parental alienation adversarial divorce arena right now. So we'll keep stay tuned and we'll keep you posted on all of that. I don't want to take too much longer talking about how successful we were, because we have somebody on the phone who is incredible, and I know you're extremely excited, and I have a friend, Wendy Archer, in Texas, who thinks so much of John's work, and so she recommended that he be on our show, and I'm so glad that we did. John is a board-certified psychiatrist, formerly of the faculty of Harvard Medical School, and the founder and director of the Unity Project, which is a resilience learning program that was developed to promote resilient strengths in youth. The Unity Project, which we'll talk about later, was conceived after John led an in-country USAID-funded trauma response program for the former Yugoslavia through Harvard School of Public Health. He is a well-known speaker. He's consulted to Congress on the creation of international criminal tribunals for the former Yugoslavia. He is all over the place. Most recently, he was in Texas giving seminars, and we are so excited to have him here tonight to talk about resiliency. Welcome, John.
Well, thank you very much, Jill. Thanks, Michelle.
When we talked about that seminar on Saturday, this was an object lesson on people trying to attain resiliency, what you're talking about. There's all forms of suffering and struggle. The ones that you've studied, at least that I have read about, are all the way from the extreme into the smaller forms as they manifest in children. So Saturday was about people who were struggling because they had lost access to their children through the divorce process. And I was wondering, when I found out we were going to get to interview you, what happened in you that made you feel that this piece needed to be really expanded and explored about resiliency?
Well, you know, it's such an interesting question. You know, when I was in my training, I vowed that I would never go into trauma studies because it's so hard. And it's I thought it would be the a career path that would just be riddled with pain. So I actually avoided it. And of course, the way fate works out, what did I become but a trauma expert? So it was part of it. It had to do with sort of a bent that I have with thinking about wellness and thinking about high-level functioning. And so, you know, all through my training, I was thinking, you know, if you want to know about, high-level mental health, I'm the last person you should ask because I'm a psychiatrist, you know, because we train in psychopathology. Or if you want to know about wellness, you don't ask a doctor because we're trained in pathology, you know. But if you want to know about wellness or high-level functioning, you have to ask somebody else. So this whole paradigm about what does the optimal look like? What would it be like if we had an optimal response to a terrible thing? And that question has just been in my mind for 30 years now. And so when I was in Croatia and Bosnia doing that work there, it just kept coming up. What would the best response to this be? And, you know, the people I found who actually came out the best, or what I would consider the best, the most resilient, they had nothing, they had no formal training, no degrees after their name, sometimes no education at all. But it was a kind of triumph of the spirit and will that was very admirable. And so I started to take apart those cases. How did they do that? How did they come to that? And from the lessons from those people and others here in this country as well. I mean, resilience isn't that uncommon. It's actually fairly common. You know, how do we turn that into programs to help kids? How do we turn it into programs to help people going through parental alienation or any other kind of trauma in life?
Well, John, crisis never leaves people the same.
Right.
So how is it, let's just kind of talk through it, how is it possible for people to bounce back from a tragedy and achieve that resiliency that you talk about?
It's a huge question, and I'm a little resistant to formulate a kind of, you know, five-step answers, you know, but there does seem to be two things that are very, very important. One is, how do we deal with a sudden realization of our powerlessness? You know, when we come to a situation where we have no power over the outcome, how do we deal with that? Because it kicks in all of our survival responses. So that's the first question. And then the second is the emotional responses that go with that, the fear, the anger, the bitterness, the anguish, and the effect that these things have on our capacity to make a decision and to move our lives forward. So it seems that fate has a way of sort of dragging us through these two questions. And something about divorce and parental alienation in particular, I don't think these are small issues because they touch a person at the very core of their identity. You know, one sees oneself and pours one all of one's identity into being a parent, into this is the best of life. And if suddenly this part of yourself is cut off from yourself, it can be paralyzing. So I think it's an enormous challenge, and not one that goes away quickly. It requires sometimes minute-by-minute monitoring of how you're doing. And you measure progress in tiny baby steps.
Let's start with, you know, I know that when you go on the speaking circuit, and I know this from personal experience, as does Jill, everybody tries to get you into the sound bites. I'm telling you, I hate it as much as you do.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the five top, you know, everybody's getting ready for the morning show.
Right. Right.
And the mere fact that people don't want to take information in anything but sound bites is problematic in itself, and probably impacts the ability to be resilient. So I want to ask you,
Yeah. If
you have major trauma like 9/11, are the skills the same as they might be from being separated from your children or going through a divorce? And I'm going to ask you about the divorce because I think our divorcing system is traumatic as well.
Yeah.
But are the skills different or... And what part does your childhood ability to adapt to trauma play into all this?
Yeah, extremely important questions. You know, when 9/11 happened, of course, all of us were shaken to the core. You know, are any of us safe? How could something like this happen? We experienced it really as a nation. And in some ways, that was a protective factor for us. That actually, in some ways, made it easier because we could adopt national goals. We could come together as people, you know. And it was one event. But if you're dealing with a very private tragedy or a very private catastrophe, that doesn't end. It doesn't end in one day or one bitter loss. But it's ongoing, and you really can't talk about it to anyone because how do you explain it? It's so complex and convoluted. It adds a dimension of isolation that is not present with an experience like 9/11. And I'm saying that in some general ways because the families who lost loved ones during 9/11, I'm not trying to diminish in any way their horrible loss, but people basically get the idea that they've had a terrible loss. and they go through the process of not being able to explain at some point what that's like, and they experience that isolation as well. But when it's a private matter like parental alienation or a very bitter divorce, there's elements of it that just simply are not socially acceptable to talk about. So this layer of isolation, I think, is a second trauma added to the divorce itself and whatever precipitated the divorce. So you have layers of anguish that you have to deal with that I think in some ways are if not different in qualitatively, they're quantitatively more intense.
That's very interesting, because it is very isolating when you're singled out as a bad parent.
Even
in the divorcing process, even though the divorce rates are 50%, you nevertheless think that your own pain is unique. So maybe support groups and what work that Jill is doing with parent alienation, maybe that has even more value than we can imagine.
Well, you know, I have to congratulate both of you, because I think this kind of show is even more helpful, because the reality is that the folks who go to support groups clearly get a lot of benefit from it. And you'll find, you always find that there's the people who they waited months and months before they actually go. But the reality is they're just the tip of the iceberg of the people who actually could benefit from the help. So providing a kind of cost-free show like this where and get information and support without having to show up at a meeting, I commend you guys. This is an important service.
Well, and
Thank
so
you.
Many people,
Thank
too,
you.
John, haven't taken the step that,
yeah.
like you said, actually coming to a meeting. They don't want to come out of the closet yet.
Right.
So
right.
So if we can provide this information and have great people like you on, it's terrific for people to be in their home and be able to listen and glean this information that they might need to work through their tragedy.
Yeah, let's go back to that isolation bit a little bit, because some of the factors that lead to it are the paralyzing elements of parental alienation that might benefit us to talk about a little bit. It might help some of the listeners too. That, you know, if you've got this notion that you're a loving parent and you know you've invested all of your life into it, and maybe you've made some mistakes, maybe you're being accused of things you didn't do. Suddenly, the whole world that you have constructed for yourself has collapsed. And so you not only become a stranger to other people, but in some ways to yourself, and you start doubting who you are to yourself. I know one person who is experiencing parental alienation who was almost embarrassed to introduce herself to me because she didn't want me to know about the accusations that had been leveled against her, as if somehow they were true. So this is a terrible thing, and if there's nothing else we get across this evening, but if a listener is in a situation like that, for them to know that they're not alone, for them to know that they are more than their feelings about this, they are more than their anguish. We start to think that we are our feelings, and we start to identify ourselves as the person who's in bitter anguish, or the person who's been terribly betrayed, and with a person whose heart's been broken. That's how we identify ourselves. And that's paralyzing. So we have to find other ways to identify ourselves that are not attached to those emotions. And a show like this helps people do that.
You're talking about defining yourself, John. And isn't it true, don't you find that people define themselves by their backgrounds first? And then when the tragedy arises, then they define themselves by what's happening to them in that moment.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to what you're saying. Sure, you know, and a lot of what's happening in that moment is loss and bitter grief and a sense of betrayal and all the emotions that go with that. Can I unravel this thought a little bit? I think it's kind of important.
Please.
You know, I worked with veterans for many years, and I'm going to draw a parallel between the experience of veterans, where you have an idealistic young man, let's say, who enlists to go to Vietnam to defend democracy and protect the good and fight for all the things that God sees are important in the world. And then you go to Vietnam, and then you find out that, 90% of the casualties are civilians, and sometimes women approach your platoon, and they've got bombs underneath their clothes and M16 or, you know, AK-47s, and you've been told that don't let anybody approach you because they might be the enemy, even if it's a woman or a child. And so your platoon has shot women, you know, sometimes completely innocent people. So you wind up doing things that are completely outside of what your expectations were, or you experience things, you see things that are not at all what you signed up for. It had nothing to do with what you enlisted for. So this causes a real break in yourself, a sense that, you know, maybe there is no good in the world. Maybe there is no God in the world. Maybe there isn't anything in me that's worth cultivating. There's no real worthy goal in life, and there's nothing in me that's particularly good anyway, because of these things I might have done. So this is paralyzing to a person's sense of motivation. So in a similar kind of way, that something like that happens when we have these great upheavals in our lives, like divorce, where we have an idea of who we are, you know, an idea of what's good, an idea of what's something worthwhile, the having a love of your life, someone you want to devote your life to, raise a family with, have kids, and suddenly whatever happens to disrupt the marriage, and it disrupts your whole worldview. It's not just the loss of a relationship; it's the destruction of your whole psychological world. And with that comes the overwhelming emotions with that loss, the anguish, the sense of anger, the sense of fear of what the future might hold, the sense of bitterness. And these emotions are stronger than anything else you may have ever experienced before. And here's the added layer of the suffering. Because if you never saw yourself as an angry person, if you never saw yourself as a fearful person, or you've never felt this kind of heartbreak before, suddenly those feelings are more strong than anything else you've ever experienced. So it's hard then to believe, let's say, in a spiritual life or anything good in your life, because those feelings were never anywhere near as strong as these horrible feelings. So
that brings to mind, because I know one of the things you're interested about is the philosophical nature of adversity.
Yeah.
The psychological resilience. One thing is that in this book called The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain, they talk about that the more adversity you have, the more potential for building baby neurons you have.
Yes. Yes.
So when you talk about people who have never seen themselves as angry before,
right,
or really angry, like the people who come into my courtroom, part of the part that is so difficult for them is that they haven't built a developmental skill for handling this kind of adversity.
Well, you're absolutely right. This is the whole point, is that we have really two brains, if you could think of it very simply. We've got a brain that's designed to help us survive, and we've got a brain that is for helping us succeed in relationships and be nurtured in a relationship and to nurture a relationship with the whole world, with humanity, with transcendent ideas, with developing culture. But they're two different brains. And the survival brain is the brain that kicks in with the fight or flight syndrome everybody's heard about. You know, when we feel threatened and we kick into survival mode. And the two major survival emotions are anger and fear. And when those two emotions kick in, they hijack your whole brain. And everything else that you experience gets filtered through the lens of either anger or fear. So have you ever been in an argument with someone and everything they say is just proof of how evil they are, you know, because the emotion of the anger just makes you interpret everything as information to justify what you're feeling.
Well, if we want to prove it, we just trigger them in a certain way, and we guarantee we get it.
Yeah, exactly. So we keep getting more of what pissed us off in the first place. So the point of all that is that if we're constantly in a situation where our survival system is being kicked off, where we're being either pushed into anger or fear, these become what we call enduring neural patterns. Habits, basically, or just think of a path through the woods that gets paved into a six-road highway. You know, it's like the neural pattern that brings you to anger or fear gets what they call overdetermined in psychological terms. So if we don't develop the capacity to quiet that part of the brain down, we wind up being governed by these instinctual emotions of fear and anger. See, fear and anger are in full force. All of our survival instincts are in full force from birth. And all of our higher emotional responses, our capacity for reciprocal love and our capacity for compassion, these are kind of like baby seeds in us when we're born. They require cultivation through repeated choices and modeling from other people. So as you say, if we get to be 28 years old or 35 years old or 40 years old and we're in a divorce situation and we don't know how to make choices to calm ourselves down and to make better choices for ourselves, then it's particularly difficult because we don't have any of the skills to respond in a resilient way. So it really does boil down to choices in the face of these overwhelming emotions. How do we calm ourselves in the midst of anguish, in the midst of a sense of betrayal or bitterness, fear or anger? How do we calm ourselves so we can actually liberate our brain to be able to think of a wider world for us, more options, other ways of being, and not be defined by these terrible survival emotions?
John, how do you see men and women making those choices differently, or is it pretty much the same? Is there a difference with gender?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, you can point to all the men are from Mars, women are from Venus, that whole thing, that we tend to attract the opposite. But I like to think of it in terms of these two emotions that everyone's sort of wired temperamentally to favor one or the other. You know, everybody has the capacity for both, fear or anger. But we sort of tend to go one way or the other. The people who are wired in terms of fear, they tend to be a little bit more introspective. And when something bad happens, they tend to think that they did it. You know, what did I do wrong? If only I had done this differently. The people who respond with anger tend to think, well, what did you do wrong? You know, so they're more externally focused. And the irony is these folks attract each other. And we fill voids in each other. And so we have rescue fantasies that the other's going to fulfill us. And then in 3 years' time, you know, one scaring the other one, and off you go. You know? So it you could say sociologically, men tend on the angry side, women tend on the fearful side. But that's not carved in stone. You can have exactly the opposite can happen as well.
Seems like, well, we shouldn't choose. Let's not choose. You talked a little bit about soldiers before.
Mm-hmm.
And when I give seminars, I talk about these studies that you're probably familiar with learned helplessness.
Sure, sure.
Positive psychology.
Right.
So first let me ask you, is there a difference between, can positive psychology help with anxiety and depression? Does it have some impact there? Or do we just treat people's depression as if it's a pathology?
Well, you know, this gets back to what we were talking about before, doesn't it, Michelle? You can view healthcare as just the elimination of symptoms and bad things, but then what positive things do you put in their place? You know, I just tell people a simple analogy. You know, if you've got a lot of shadow in a room or a lot of darkness in a room, you don't take away the darkness. You shine a light in it. You know, so you know if you want to get rid of a set of symptoms, the first question you should ask is what are the opposites of it? What would be the opposite strength? So you need to do whatever you can to diminish the negative consequences of the bad thing, but you have to be also engaged in building up the positives. And that's something that I think the general field of psychology, psychiatry, healthcare in general is a bit behind on. The field of positive psychology is very exciting because this is its focus. How do we build up those strengths? And the field of resilience has sort of mushroomed out are in sort of in parallel with this field of positive psychology. So that the question then becomes, what are the skill sets? What are these positive skill sets that if you know them, you're better able to move through these kinds of crises? The first one, I think, it has to do with calming that part of the brain down that is on survival mode, that the emergency alarm that goes off when we feel hurt or betrayed, where anger and grief fear kick in particular. So being able to catch yourself when you're in the middle of those things and not let them spiral into all the things they degenerate into, like depression and alienation and despair.
I know some exercises that I've made up, but could you give us some? You're angry, you're furious, you're in the crescendo. What do you do to bring yourself to the other, to start bringing it down? Do you just wait for the adrenaline, the count? You know, we know counting to 20 does matter, but do you just wait for the adrenaline load to dissipate or what?
Yeah, well, it's an excellent question. It's kind of like an onion, the way you think about it. You know, the thing I tell couples, you know, once you blow up, you know, the first thing you got to do is don't throw any more gas on the fire. So, you know, you have to de-escalate before you solve any problem. There's no problem solving as long as you're angry or afraid, yeah, because you're on survival mode. You're not on problem solving mode. So, yeah, the first layer is go to neutral corners, you know. And this is where partners can help each other because, like, if let's say one partner has a sort of an unconscious habit of accusing the other person of things they didn't do, but doesn't really realize they do that, and the other person has a habit of short fuse, and before you know it, they're very reactive, and one has insulted the other, and the other has exploded into a rage, you know, in 3 seconds. So, you know, the couple has to kind of not go after scoring points. You have to create a space where you can both back off. So if the one who got angry sort of, you know, gets quiet for a few seconds, the best situation would be where the couple had kind of worked out beforehand that, you know, if the person who's angry gets quiet for a few seconds, that means they're trying to regroup. So don't throw any more gas on the fire at that point. Don't accuse them of anything or don't blame them or say, they see, there you go again. Give them, you know, maybe say something like, why don't we take 10 minutes and come back at this when we both can bring our best out? Because right now we're going the wrong way.
There's a statement in the chat room. Mediation is such a profound tool at this point as a regular practice because it helps give you a gap before responding and bringing in a more calm state to the negotiation.
It's such a huge breakthrough in divorce, in handling divorces. You know, I just said at this workshop I did down in Texas a couple weeks ago that, you know, most marriages end in 3 minutes. It's those first 3 minutes of a fight. If you can find a way to calm things down or at least not throw gas on the fire in those 3 minutes, you have a chance. So, you know, part of it's physiological. If you are flooded with adrenaline in a rage, you may say in your head, you know, I need to calm down. I need a couple of minutes. I just blew up. I don't want to blow up. I feel bad about it. All that might happen in a tenth of a second in your head, but you're still, your heart's pumping and your eyes are wide and you look like a crazy person. So the other person's still seeing the crazy person, but in your head, you've already made a little bit of a change. So you really physiologically need a few minutes to let the adrenaline cool out a little bit. You've got to do things like take a few breaths or... And we know neurologically that just simply recognizing your emotional state all by itself starts the process of decreasing your what they call your arousal. It starts to change your brain waves and your stress hormone levels, you know, like within a few seconds. So, but that process takes some time. So timeouts really do count. And the reason I say 3 minutes, that most marriages end in 3 minutes, is because once that 3 minute mark is hit, if you're still escalating, it's going to take a long time to calm the situation down. You can do a lot of damage to your spouse. You can break a lot of trust and say a lot of things you didn't mean in 3 minutes or in the 10 minutes after that. So I really try to counsel people, watch the beginnings. You know, really be careful of those first that first minute and a half or so where you're lobbing grenades at each other, and, you know, find a way to step back then before it gets ugly.
And then let's put lawyers into the mix.
Yeah.
Okay. Jill, and have them really, and I'm not saying intentionally, the code is, you know, zealous advocacy. I'm not drawing a negative inference, but let's talk about the real psychodynamic of having a gladiator actualize your anger,
right,
more so maybe than you even have it, and what that does to families.
Right.
That's one thing. Then so that's just part one of the question. How does that work, and is that a good thing to for our souls to get someone to amp up the anger for us? What's your opinion?
Well,
no.
You want to ask Jill that one, or are you throwing that at me?
Oh, no,
you. You
I know what Jill.
Okay.
I shouldn't say that. That's not good communication.
Well, no, my sense is that it's hugely tragic. I mean, there are definitely some cases. You know, I know a lot of the people who created some of the precedent for this in Massachusetts to, you know, to strongly advocate for women who have been physically abused, for instance, and to, you know, to make no exceptions to questions about the potential for abuse, that the burden of proof was on the man to prove that he's not abusive because the stakes were so high. And in a percentage of cases, that's a good thing. I mean, thank goodness for those sorts of protections. But there are, I wish I knew the numbers, but the people I see are not in that category, or many, many, many of them are not. And what happens is that you have things like restraining orders used as, you know, leverage to gain position for the final settlement and for custody and things like that. And it may not even be something that the spouse intended. But they're putting their trust in, they've just lost trust in their spouse. They might hold some hope out that they can regain it, but they have to trust someone, so they trust a system, you know, and they have no idea that the system isn't set up for reconciliation. It's set up that someone wins and someone loses. So the lawyer sees their job is to make sure that their client wins. So,
well, what about resiliency from a lawyer? I'm breaking it down because there's lots of things in the system that people need to be able to do some mental training, resiliency skills.
Yeah.
But let's just say you're bullied by the other side's lawyer. That activates in people a very primitive response and a very childlike response because they're terrified.
Yeah. Well,
how do you withstand that?
Well, this is the thing, and you brought up mediation. You know, if you can get a decent mediator, that's the way to go. You know, because really, once it hits courts, once it hits, you know, the adversarial process, it's going to hell. I mean, the whole process is going to hell, and you know, it's going to be claim and counterclaim, and you know, one's going to be Godzilla, and the other's going to be you know, King Kong. And, you know, people that you thought you knew are going to be made into, you know, these horrible, horrible monsters. And it's tragic for everyone involved that one terrible accusation and restraining order just makes the other person dig in even deeper into their survival responses. And so if there was anything good in the relationship, it's destroyed. And so the tender, fragile, nuanced environment you need for healing is just consumed in the fire of all the accusations. So
well,
you need
John,
a very...
I don't want to continue. And Michelle, if that's okay with you, because there might be some people listening who are not having parental alienation problems, who are not having divorce issues, but have had some trauma, loss of a child, or you know, had a family member in 9/11 or something like that.
Yeah.
I want to ask John one question from the
sure.
chat room, and then I want to just go into generalities about how we stay positive in trying to reach resiliency. And what you've got the five R's. I want to hear about the five R's. But
okay.
Before we do that, there is a question from a young lady, and she is asking, is there a simple calming technique for parents, target parents, who are alienated from their children, who have very little contact. Do you have some sort of just technique that they can use to stay calm and not get angry and not go into desperate or into despair?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the first thing I'd like to say is my heart breaks for the situation you're in. Unfortunately, you're not alone. It's very isolating and tragic. And again, it gets back to that sense of powerlessness. The thing you love the most, you have no power over. So this is very, very debilitating on one level. So there are actually this is kind of a way to bring in those five R's. The thought is that progress in any one of these five areas will help you begin to develop the resilient muscles you need to get through. Doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have some, you know, go from bitter anguish to, singing in a minute or two. But what it does mean is that you're going to start taking the pain and transforming it into something better, using the energy of it to develop strengths that will not only strengthen your character, but in the long run will make you a better parent in the situation, and that becomes visible over time to the people who are doing the alienating. So the first R, I call it reflection. And what I mean by this, it's an abbreviation for a whole lot of skills. And I reduced these to five because there are just so many things you can do. I wanted to sort of categorize them. But this first one is reflection. And what I mean by that is first is a recognition that when we feel powerless, it will automatically kick in our survival emotions. And those survival emotions will be fear, there'll be anger, there'll be bitterness, and all of these things that come with it. And we start to think of ourselves as that's who we are. So we need to develop the ability to step back and say, no, I'm more than these feelings. Right? And we also need to develop the skills to quiet those feelings down. And so there's all sorts of meditation practices. The easiest thing you can do is number one is note that just by simply saying to yourself, I am not my feelings, and really, I embrace my feelings, I'm glad I have them, but I am more than my feelings. I am more than this bitterness. I am more than this anguish. It just saying that begins to quiet your, it's called your amygdala, your midbrain, the part that is red hot with all these emotions. You start to quiet it down by using your cortex, the outer part of your brain. The brain stem, when you're in these sorts of emotions, is super activated, and it's directing the control of the brain from the base of the brain towards the top, and that's what happens when we're in survival mode. But when we start to say things to ourselves to calm ourselves down, we reverse the flow and we start to control the brain from our cortex, from the outer part of the brain, and we start to calm down the inner part of the brain. And that's what we want. So saying things like, I am more than my emotions, and really, really finding a way to believe that is important. We need to calm the body down. There's all kinds of ways to do this. Exercise is extremely important. Water, hot and cold water, showers are a good thing. Breathing is absolutely essential. Learning, just simply taking three deep breaths, what we call diaphragmatic breaths, which are, actually I should take one right now. I just show you how to do it. When you're nervous and excited, you'll notice that your breathing is in the top of your lungs. It's rapid and shallow. And a lot of times we're breathing this way and don't even realize it. And what winds up happening is that it becomes a vicious cycle that this kind of breathing is caused by stress, but keeping this kind of breathing perpetuates the body's response to stress. So if you consciously bring your awareness to it, and this is the key to all resilience building, is conscious choice. Because if you bring the conscious choice, okay, I feel my breathing is like this upper lung breathing, I'm going to make a conscious choice to breathe from my diaphragm. So you stop, like I just did, and you take a deep breath through your nose and fill up your, like you're breathing into your, and you let your stomach slowly fill with air, expand the lower part of your lungs, and the middle part of your lungs, and the top of your lungs. And then you just naturally let it out of your mouth. Wait a few seconds, do it again, and do that. If you do that three times, there's actually neurological studies that show that it changes the brain waves. It begins to calm that red-hot part of the brain down that's caught up in the grief and the anguish. It begins to quiet it down. So you're using a physiological act to calm your physiology down. You're using a body technique to calm down your body. If you add to that a conscious thought, for instance, the thought that I said, I am more than my feelings, you know, something like that, it adds a cognitive element to the bodily response, right? If you say, you can say all sorts of affirmations at that point, you know, there's all sorts of spiritual affirmations, you know, light flows through me, I'm a channel to powers greater than me. I pick one, you know, if it's from your religious tradition, whatever resonates with the higher part of yourself. Use the time when you're calming your body down as the time to state those affirmations to yourself. It sounds like voodoo and it sounds like New Age crap, but it's actually physiologically tremendously effective. These things have very powerful effects on quieting the brainstem and the midbrain down and giving you a fighting chance to start to have some control over your thoughts and your feelings. So that first
even walking, thing, right? If you, let's say you can't get it together to work out.
Yeah, right.
Walking is really powerful too, in the same way, right?
Absolutely. Any kind of physical activity. Yep, absolutely. And the purpose of it is not just to calm the brain down, which is the first priority, but it's also to begin to develop the capacity to step back from those strong feelings and say to yourself, I am more than this. So you can reflect. You know, you can say this is a horrible situation, but I am not this horrible situation, or my daughter or my child is not. We are more than this. You know? So the ability to step back from the experience and observe it objectively is critical to any forward progress with resilience. You have to develop that ability to stand back from the experience, that objective ability to stand back and observe it, without being overwhelmed with fear, anger, anguish, despair. And, you know, you may have to do it 1,000 times a day, but hey, then just look at it as a process. It's not a goal that you reach in one day or one week or one month, but it's like exercise. You're exercising the muscle of your willpower and the willpower that is saying that I'm more than these strong feelings. And that is the foundation around which all the other resilient strengths build from. So how are we doing? I've got the 3-week version of this. I've got the 2-day version of this.
I'm sure you do. So we did reflection.
Uh-huh. So reflection.
Oh, that's the kind of global piece that's going to hit all of the rest of them, I would imagine.
It does. And we kind of bled into the second one, which is reframe. You have to, as long as you're caught up in the fear or the anger, all your interpretations of the situation come to the conclusion that you should still be afraid or still be angry. So you know you're kind of still caught up in it when the only conclusions you can draw about your life is that I'm utterly, utterly without options. You know, I'm destined to be in this despairing situation forever. I'll never get out of it. I mean, as long as those are the conclusions you come to, you're still caught up in the survival emotion. Well,
but John, are there people
way.
That look at it in a different way? Because I don't remember ever thinking that in the face of tragedy. I don't remember ever thinking I don't have an option. I don't have
that.
The only thing I could think was, I have to make this better. So is there just two schools of thought, one negative and one positive toward resiliency?
I think, Jill, that's part of your resilience.
Okay.
I think that's part of your resilience, is that you were able to say, I have a choice in this. That's fantastic. So
is that biological?
Mean you didn't suffer.
Is that biological, or is that how she was raised, or?
It's a good question. It looks like it's both. The best research looks like it's a little bit of both. And you're in the same family. You can have one kid who does real well, and another one, same experience, doesn't do well. So we'd have to, you know, go through your whole background. But clearly, you've got an ability to say, you know, no matter what happens, I've got some options here. This is the cornerstone of resilience, is to know that. Doesn't mean you didn't suffer. What it does mean is that you had a boat to get through those choppy seas.
The way I do the reframe, the way I configured it in my book, it was called a Proustian exercise, because Proust always looked at the multi-facets of every intention.
Uh-huh.
And you take something you're really angry at,
uh-huh,
and you write three different possible interpretations.
Perfect.
And whether or not you're right or wrong or even believe it, just the reframing in your mind, I think, lets a little oxygen into the freeze frame of anger. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think you're right. And
I don't know what I'm doing, but somehow it works sometimes.
You clearly do know what you're doing. That's excellent. So tell me, what's the name of your book?
The Good Karma Divorce.
Okay. Well, I'm going out and getting it, because that's a great technique. I like that very much.
Well, the other one is the limitation technique. You write down the person who made you angry, a list of their limitations. By the time you're done with their list, you realize they couldn't have acted in any other way. That does the same thing.
Boy, you said something so important, that ultimately, and this has proven to be the case working with, you know, survivors of war, survivors of genocide, survivors of massive, you know, genocidal rape. I mean, ultimately, the truth is kind. There's a kindness to it, that where there's a sense of understanding that the other person, given all that who they are, that's the best they could do. You know, once the element of blame leaves your the framing of your understanding, you're on the road to health. And that doesn't mean at all that other people's, they shouldn't be accountable to their actions. I don't mean that at all. But as long as an element of blame is in your thinking, it means that the pain has still gripped you, that you haven't found it yet.
John, are you speaking of blame of yourself or blame of someone else?
It can be both.
Or both.
And I'm not saying that we absolve ourselves or others of responsibility. But what I am talking about is, as long as we cripple ourselves with a sense of blame that either the other person is irretrievably evil, or there's something irretrievably evil about ourselves that paralyzes our ability to make a decision, or in relation to the other person, makes us feel that we're constantly waiting for them to change for us to feel better. It boils down to, as long as we're blaming, we think that the control of our lives is outside of ourselves. That's really the bottom line. So it's not to absolve a person of responsibility, but it's a psychological point I'm making, that at some point we need to recognize, like you did, Jill, that you have the capacity to make a decision to make something different. And by the way, that's the fourth R. That's I call it responsibility. We have to find a way to bring the responsibility into our own hearts and choice, and not see that our welfare is determined by external events.
And I think, Michelle, that plays right into your chapter on forgiveness. I mean, you have to, exactly what you said to do, you have to forgive yourself, and you have to forgive and take responsibility for what happened in the conflict that you were in, and you feel so much better when you do it.
Yeah.
Somehow it's really healing.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
Blame is very disempowering, because any blame stamps to anybody, I think it's got very leaky boundaries, and all of a sudden you could be a victim to just about anybody.
Yeah.
You know, if you can be a victim to one, then somebody can do something to you. It's a very tricky strategy, blame, because before you know it, you know, then your mother did something to you, and then God did something to you.
Right.
It's very leaky, and it's really tricky. It's seductive. We all want to do it, but...
Yeah. Yeah,
well, John,
I think you really said it. That's a good, you said it well. It's everyone I've ever talked to who is, and myself included, when I'm caught up in blame or this kind of anger, I have really good reasons to be caught up in it. You know, so people have good reasons to be attached to their anger or their fear or their sense of betrayal. But the point is that at some point, it's not about being right. It's about being free. How do you free yourself from the captivity of this rage? At some point, the rage and the anger and the betrayal and the despair can become what define you. And so, as you mentioned, these leaky boundaries, at some point we have to realize that freedom is what it's all about. How do I free myself from an external event that has seemed to have captured my heart? You know, I need to become the master of my own heart again. So blame is one of those things. If you are able to see with an understanding eye what happened and see the full weight of the loss and the grief that went with it, but then not hold on to it. This is a great psychological strength. It's a great spiritual strength, and it's very healing for relationships that maybe 10 years after a bitter divorce or 20 years after a bitter divorce, people find that they find a way back to be kind to each other again, and that's ultimately what opens the door for reconciliation between alienated parents and kids. Is a person who has kind of been mellowed into a humility through this pain. Remember, I said the first thing is to recognize our powerlessness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Until a sense of humility and connection to the tragic human condition enters that equation, that sense of powerlessness feeds all the negative things in human nature, the fear and the anger, all these terrible cycles of destruction. But once we come to the point of recognizing in a humble way that we're all human beings and so frail and fragile and prone to error, and that sense of forgiveness enters, then we can be healthy. We can be free again.
Sometimes so you have the word for compassion that begins
left.
With R?
What'd you say, Michelle? Sorry, I was talking over you. What'd you say, Michelle?
Oh, I was asking Dr. Woodall, does he have the word for compassion that begins with an R? Because we still need 3 and 5.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. The first one is reflecting, and we talked about that. The second is reframing, and I like the way you did it, Michelle. We'll stick with those. The third, you need to do those first two so you can do the third. The third one doesn't happen unless you do the first two, and that I call it reassessment. You have to now look at it's like this. You have to empty the cup before you can fill it with good stuff. So you have to empty the cup of all the anger and the bitterness and fear so that you can now, in the second stage of reframing, see the big picture, right, free of those emotions. And now that you've done that, you do the third thing, which is reassessment, which is kind of like what you did with that second exercise, looking at the particulars of your situation, no longer in the grips of the fear or the anger, but seeing from a bigger picture that ultimately is a compassionate one. And then problem solve according to the specifics of the situation and not hauling the past, these emotions that kind of distort our perceptions. So this is kind of in a nutshell. All of this is involved with this fourth R, which I call it different things depending on how I'm approaching it. One is this notion of responsibility. We talked about that. Gradually over time, as we develop strength day by day through a constant process, we develop the ability to become more responsible for our own happiness. And we have to give ourselves a huge dose of compassion and slack and patience, because this doesn't happen in a day. It doesn't happen sometimes in a week or a month or a year or 5 years. It can take many years, sometimes stretching over most of a lifetime. So it's not about the time frame. It's about continued effort to make those compassionate choices. So, and then the last R, the fifth R, is relationship. All of this is about healthy, nurturing relationships. We can, if we're having trouble calming ourselves down and calming our body down, finding some healthy other person, or even not so healthy other person, who can give you some sort of comfort. I think community is extremely important. You talked earlier about these support groups and certainly a radio program like this. You've created community on this radio program. So something as simple as this is hugely helpful to someone who feels isolated and cut off and doesn't feel like they're able to control their own emotions yet. They're too caught up in it just yet. So being around other people who are engaged in the process is extremely helpful. This is one of the things people in AA say all the time. You know, they don't feel they have a chance in hell in staying sober, but they just get around other people who are trying to be sober, and it's helpful. People who grieve are the same way. You might not feel any control over your grief, but if you're around other people who've been through it, it's helpful. So community is extremely important, and ultimately we're building skills that are helping us become harmless nurturers, where we're not engaged in harming relationships we're in, and we're not allowing harmful relationships to happen back at us. We're engaged in nurturing others and being nurtured by them. And this is really it's kind of the beginning, middle, and end of the whole process. You know, we need to enter into relationships like that to help ourselves heal. We need to develop the skills to maintain relationships like that. And the final outcome are healthy relationships.
So tell us about the Unity Project. That was absolutely terrific.
And we've only got about 4 minutes, John, and I want to get your contact information and everything. So in a nutshell, what is the Unity Project, please?
Well, the Unity Project is something that I put together after I got back from the Balkans and the war there and saw that, you know, this whole approach of just dealing with pathology is kind of, you know, backwards, putting the cart before the horse. So how do we develop skills in kids where we do what we were just talking about, where we help them develop supportive, nurturing community with each other to develop the resilient skills they need to be successful with their friends and their relationships, you know, as citizens. So we engage kids in service as a way, we talk about, you know, everybody has gems inside them that they need to bring out, that that really what's most of what the purpose of life is we've got skills and abilities and wonderful qualities that are like gems hidden in a mountain, and we need to bring them out, and that requires effort. And one of the ways to bring them out is the arts. Another way to bring them out is through service to other people, and quite frankly, maybe the biggest way is through suffering. You know, this is where our best qualities come out over time. So what we try to do is we engage kids in service as a way to then bring out their hidden talents and skills, and then we help them refine those skills through a variety of what we call transformation exercises. So we work in after-school programs and schools, and we're just in beginning the process of developing training materials for people in youth programs and churches and synagogues and things like that. So
John, the program is for all kids, not just kids who have had a tragedy in their life.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things we're excited about, is it's anybody can take advantage of this. It winds up being a leadership development program, because kids wind up learning how to get through whatever they're dealing with in their life, whether it's, you know, just dealing with homework or all the way up to a war. The same sets of skills apply, just to a different degree.
Well, how do we find out about the Unity Project if we want information?
Well, probably the easiest thing is to go to my blog, which is johnwoodall.net, and John is J-O-H-N, and Woodall is wood like a tree and all like everything, woodall.net, and there's a whole section there on the Unity Project, and I also have a website for the Unity Project. It's unityproject.org, and there's also a Facebook page.
Good. Michelle, do you have any final thoughts?
If people want to participate in the Unity Project, if they go on your website, that will help them, because people need to get this out into the school programs. Our children don't stand a chance unless they learn these resiliency skills. Anybody listening would want to be hands-on about this. Can they do that if they get on this website?
Yeah, the website isn't the way to do that. The way to do that would be to go to Facebook and do the Unity Project. To the blog, johnwoodall.net, and then just write me a note under one of the comments on one of the Unity Project posts there, and I'd be happy to respond.
Because I know I do. I think it is just essential, and it's missing.
Yeah.
So you're on an uphill climb because there's no funding in the schools.
Well, this is it.
Be a way to get this kind of information, ethics training, moral dilemma training, resiliency building, the real things that people need.
Yeah. Well, you're right.
Thank you both. I have to stop us now because this hour has flown by. But, John, we'd love to have you on again and talk about just children and resiliency, if you would take the time to do that.
I'd be happy to. I just have to thank the two of you. This is a wonderful program, a great idea, and I'm sure you're helping an awful lot of people doing it.
Thank you. We hope so. Thanks so much for your time and your wisdom.
Have a wonderful evening, and I'm glad everybody was listening. Thanks so much.
Okay. Take care now.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.